My Classic Album with Mike Norris is part of Podnose, the UK's leading independent entertainment podcasting network. For episode archives of My Classic Album and all of the shows on the network, visit us at www.podnose.com. You can also follow us on Twitter at Podnose or send us an email via admin@podnose.com.
It's just like a wall of awesomeness coming at you. That's how I would describe the whole album.
It's just been a lot of fun for me, Mike, to talk with you about this album at this moment.
It's something that everybody should hear at least once in their life.
It's fucking amazing!
You're listening to My Classic Album with Mike Norris.
Hello everyone and welcome to My Classic Album, the show that looks back on some of the greatest albums in music history. I'm Mike Norris, thank you very much for joining me. In for a treat today, really looking forward to you all here in today's episode. My special guest, Tim Atkinson from the band Leader of Down, has chosen a Motorhead album. I'm a huge Motorhead fan, really excited that we're finally doing a Motorhead album. And it seems that for Tim, this will be the perfect one to go for. Obviously why he's picked it, we're going to be looking at Motorhead's 1986 album Orgasmatron. That album is the studio debut of guitarist Wurzel, who Tim actually collaborated with to form Leader of Down before Wurzel's passing in 2011. So again, this journey that we're taking on with Tim, from being a fan of Motorhead to getting to a point where he forms a band and a friendship with Wurzel. Obviously got to know Lemmy as well. Lemmy appears on the first studio album for Leader of Down as well. So Leader of Down, a really kind of important part of the story of Motorhead, I guess, in kind of those latter years. So, you know, great conversation to talk about Orgasmatron, and within that, kind of the genesis of Leader of Down as well. And some really cool stories about Wurzel, about Lemmy, about Motorhead in general. So a great chat that I'm looking forward to you all hearing. So that's coming up in just a few minutes. But I hope you're all really enjoying yourselves this summer. You know, we're really getting stuck into some great episodes here. I'm keeping myself busy too. Let's get stuck into some of these episodes that we're going to be doing over the next few months on My Classic Albums. So we do have Terry DeWitt from the fantastic band Deep Fall. That's our next episode in a couple of weeks' time. And he has chosen Alice in Chains' second album, Dirt. Again, it's our first Alice in Chains album. Dirt is certainly the perfect album to kick off our kind of Alice in Chains journey. You know, I'm sure that we'll cover them again in the future. And it's great, you know, as well, because obviously we've looked at grunge albums in the past. We've done a couple of Nirvana albums. We've looked at Soundgarden's Super Unknown. So it was about time that Alice in Chains kind of made their My Classic Album debut. And, you know, Dirt, it's a very dark album. You know, it's a very deep album. But Terry and I, you know, I think we approached it with a bit of levity. We had a bit of fun with it too. And, you know, I did a poll on the My Classic Album Facebook page about all these episodes that are coming up. And it seemed like this is the one, at least the album, that people are most excited to hear get the My Classic Album treatment. So that's coming in a couple of weeks. We're then going to spend a bit of time with a band that I'm really excited about. Sixth Sense are an up-and-coming new metal band. And obviously, you know, new metal has been around for a long time. You know, it's a genre that gets a lot of kicking sometimes, but I'm very much, you know, proudly kind of, you know, raise my hand and say that I'm a huge fan of new metal even to this day. You know, we did Linkin Park's Hybrid Theory back a couple of weeks ago. Sixth Sense are kind of flying that new metal flag. They consist of some really talented musicians, including Robbie J. Fonts, who many of you will know as the current lead singer of Stuck Mojo. Robbie will be coming on the show in a couple of weeks' time to talk about Slipknot's debut album. So that's pretty cool. Again, Slipknot were a band that maybe at first passed me by as a teenager, and it's more as I've become an adult that I've really sort of started to enjoy and appreciate the band and the influence that they've had. So Slipknot's 1999 debut, that chat with Robbie will be coming up towards the end of August. And then at the start of September, I'm going to be joined by Robbie's wife, Vicky Sirakis, who many of you will know not only as a member of Sixth Sense, but also as the vocalist of The Agonist. So Vicky has chosen Evanescence as Fallen. A lot of debuts coming up over the next few weeks, but these are really important albums, and similar to Hybrid Theory and Slipknot, these are, you know, the bands to around the time of the millennium that, you know, we do a lot of albums on My Classic Album from the 70s, the 80s, the 90s. we're starting to kind of look over the new millennium with a new eye and starting to get that idea of, you know what, these are classic albums. They're approaching 20 years old or over 20 years old. Let's look at them through that lens. So it's really exciting for me to be doing the likes of Linkin Park, Slipknot, Evanescence, and giving them the same kind of treatment that we give bands like Motorhead, Iron Maiden, and so many more. Some great episodes coming up throughout the summer. Really, really excited for you to hear my chats with the guys from Sixth Sense, with Terry, and of course, you know, again, today, my chat with Tim that's coming up really soon. Let's get into things. My special guest for today is Tim Atkinson from Leader of Down, who has chosen a hugely influential album for him in Motorhead's Orgasmatron. But before we get to my chat with Tim, all about this great, underrated Motorhead album, I'd say, let's have a look at the facts. Here's the beginning of what you need to know about Orgasmatron. Orgasmatron is the seventh studio album from British rock band Motorhead. After the success of their earlier albums in the late 70s and early 80s, Motorhead were dropped by Bronze Records, with their popularity seemingly on the wane. With only founder Lemmy Kilmister left from the classic lineup, Lemmy set about establishing a new era for Motorhead, with both Wizzle and Wurzel recruited as a dual guitar attack, and Pete Gill on drums. After extensive touring, the band's management formed GWR Records, giving the band control over their own studio output. Orgasmatron was the first Motorhead release on the label, released on 9th of August 1986. Death Forever was the sole single released from Orgasmatron, reaching number 67 on the UK Singles Chart. However, many of the tracks would become fan favourites, including the aforementioned single, title track Orgasmatron, and live favourite Dr. Rock. Their first studio album in 3 years, and with a new lineup, the release of Orgasmatron proved there was still an appetite for Motorhead from their rabid fanbase. Orgasmatron reached number 21 on the UK album chart and number 157 on the US Billboard 200, coming close to mirroring the success of predecessor Another Perfect Day. Orgasmatron also charted in the band's usual haunts, including Australia, Germany, and the Netherlands. While not their most successful or critically acclaimed album, Orgasmatron is an important album in the career of Motorhead, revitalising the band's career following their departure from Bronze Records. The introductions of Wurzel and Phil Campbell would mark a new chapter in the Motorhead story and seal their fate as one of the all-time great British rock bands. So that's just the beginning of everything we need to know about Orgasmatron, and I have here with me my very special guest who chose the album to talk about today here on My Classic Album from Leader of Down. This is Tim Atkinson. How's it going?
Hello, Mike. Very well, thank you. How are you?
I'm great, thank you. And about time we did a Motorhead album. Really excited to get stuck into this. Why have you chosen Orgasmatron to talk about on My Classic Album today?
I think it's quite hard when you're trying to pick a, you know, your classic album or your favourite album, because I think a lot of it also has to do with what you were doing maybe at the time it came out or something like that. It's certainly not one of Motorhead's sort of top three or four most famous records, but it tends to normally get in the top 10 of people's, you know, choices with Motorhead. And it just holds dear memories and for me, and I love the record.
I mean, talking about those dear memories, what are your memories of hearing it for the first time? What was going on for you when you discovered this album?
Well, I'd seen Motorhead as a very young kid when I was in America on a school football trip. Basically hoodwinked the family I was staying with in America that I was always allowed to go and see Motorhead when I was back home, which wasn't true. Although they were my favourite group, I had never seen them. So they took me with their two children, one of them who was 9 years old, to see Motorhead playing in Buffalo in New York. And it was unbelievable. But of course, then when I got home, now the ammunition I needed with my parents to say I'd been to see them. So it's quite okay for me to do that. So this was the first sort of studio album after I'd seen them. They'd released Killed by Death and some of the ones they put on the No Remorse compilation, and I absolutely loved, and the new lineup with Wurzel, Phil Campbell and Pete Gill. And then we were waiting, everyone was waiting for this new studio album. So it was like a sort of big anticipation, and then Orgasmatron came out, and I was in the fan club, and I remember hearing that it was going to be called Riding with the Driver, and there was a great cover and everything. And then obviously as time went on, they didn't call it Riding with the Driver, they called it Orgasmatron. And it was I got it the day it came out, you know, I was so excited.
And I mean, you've said it yourself, you know, it's not necessarily in terms of kind of the more kind of notable albums or ones that have sold well. some people might be surprised that we haven't got stuck in at the likes of Ace of Spades or Bomber or something like that. For you personally, is it just around that context of what was going on at the time? Is that why it's the definitive Motorhead album for you personally?
Yeah, I think so. But also what happened, you know, years later when I got friendly with the band and me and Wurzel became great friends. And then we, you know, recorded together and formed Leader of Down. But I would talk for ages with Wurzel about this record because that was his first studio album with Motorhead. So he had lots of happy memories of it. And it almost felt, you know, having known so much about it from the other side as a fan, then chatting with Wurzel and Phil Campbell as well about it, you know, it sort of filled in some of the questions you might have had, or they told you how they were feeling when they were doing it, because they were all so excited to be recording a full-length studio album. And it was such an important album because after Brian Robertson had his sort of short-lived stay with the band, they really needed to come back with something that sort of took no prisoners. And that's what they did.
And I mean, it's a really unique story for you in terms of this being your classic album. Because like you say, obviously you got friendly with the band, particularly with Wurzel. You know, you formed your current band together. And, you know, what kind of impact would you say, again, thinking about that young Motorhead fan who kind of managed to kind of sneak to a gig without his parents knowing, to then come full circle and be working so closely with Wurzel. What was that like?
I get asked that quite a lot, and I always think I don't give a very good answer because it's very hard to explain. One of the things I would say is because Motorhead were my favourite band, and I never, if you sort of excuse the phrase, grew out of them. They were always my favourite band. They still are my favourite band, and I love everything about them. And I'm very lucky that my favourite band went on for 40 years. You know, I could have picked a band that did one album and two singles, and that would have been it. Actually, becoming friends with them, working with them and knowing them all so well is something that I couldn't have envisaged in my wildest dreams when I was sort of 10, 11 years old. You know, I mean, it was just ludicrous because I was learning to play the bass guitar at that age. So if I was ever going to work with them in my sort of naive young years, I would have thought in my head, well, that would mean that Lemmy would have to leave because they wouldn't have two bass players. So it just didn't compute. So it was a strange thing. And obviously I like other bands, of course, but if I'd, for example, worked with AC/DC, that would be great and I would love it, but it wouldn't have the same personal feeling to me as doing things with Motorhead.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, I mean, as I'd said to you right at the start, I'm really excited we're finally doing a Motorhead album. Like, I've been a fan of them for a long time. One of the things that I maybe kind of butt heads with people about is people who maybe only have like a casual knowledge of the band. And I think of a really close friend of mine that whenever I mention them, like I'd said, obviously I've seen them, obviously back in the day I saw them kind of on three or four occasions. And he would often say to me like, oh, did they just sing Ace of Spades 20 times? And it was almost this assertion that they were merely a singles band, or even worse, kind of a one-hit wonder, which is nonsense. Is it wrong to kind of dismiss them as a singles band when there's these kind of great albums like Orgasmatron, Ace of Spades, Bomber, all these fantastic albums that they produced?
Oh, most definitely. I think the thing is with Motorhead, you've really got to get into it. You've got to, you know, and as you delve deeper, you get, there's some fantastic tracks, you know, and there's some songs that are very, very catchy. You know, as we talk more about this album, Orgasmatron, songs like Ate My Crime off the record is a very catchy song. And I think, for example, if it was done by a different band and Lemmy wasn't singing it with his sort of gruff vocals, you'd actually realise what a catchy song it is, just as a song. And they had some brilliant tracks. And it's the same, you know, as people often say, oh, they sound the same. But they don't like them in the first place. That's why they keep saying that. You know, it's. I think you can probably say that the same about every band. But, of course, they were going for 40 years. They're not going to try and sound different on every single record because that's not the point, really.
So, I mean, Orgasmatron, it was the first studio album, as you'd said, from Motorhead in about 3 years, following 1983's Another Perfect Day. That was the longest gap at that point between Motorhead albums at the time. It was also 2 years since that compilation album, No Remorse. So, Ultimate Classic Rock say, to many fans, No Remorse signalled not only the end of Motorhead's long and fruitful partnership with Bronze Records, but perhaps the end of the band itself. After all the preceding convoluted years had witnessed the departure of guitarist Fast Eddie Clarke and drummer Filthy Animal Taylor, at that point thinking, you know, if we're thinking we're in the mid-80s, do you think that there was the potential that that kind of dissolvement of that classic lineup, that that could potentially have spelt the end of the band?
Well, I think it could have done if Lemmy hadn't been so determined to not give up. And you've probably heard Lemmy say lots of times, you know, the only way you fail is if you give up. And he wasn't going to give up. So on he went. And of course, at one point, and Lemmy said it many times, he was the only member of the band, because with Filthy Animal Taylor, when they were auditioning the guitarist, they were choosing between Wurzel and Phil Campbell. Eventually, obviously, took both of them. And then Filthy Animal Taylor left. So, but Filthy had left just before they decided. So at one point, there was only one person. Mm-hmm. So when they did the Young Ones show, they had to get Filthy to come back from memory for that show. Because they hadn't really announced to the world that he'd gone. And then, of course, Pete Gill came in. So it was a new thing entirely. I mean, it was literally a brand new band.
Absolutely. And it's like you say, obviously, again, just for that clarity for anyone, that new lineup, of course, you know, we've got Lemmy, who's very much kind of the figurehead of all of this. We've got Pete Gill coming in on drums, and then we've got Wurzel and Phil Campbell. So this introduction of two guitarists, you know, Phil, of course, stayed with Motorhead right until Lemmy's passing in 2015. So this marked the first time that Motorhead moved away from being this kind of power trio that they're renowned for in favour of becoming like a four-piece. What impact would you say that has on the sound that we hear on this album?
Well, the first time I saw the four-piece was their first show at Hammersmith. I can only say, and it's a bit of a cliche, but literally at school, for the next 2 days, the ringing in my ears was absolutely unbelievable. I couldn't hear the maths teacher at all where I was sitting in the class if they were sort of dropping the volume of their voice. It was so loud because, of course, you then had this situation when one of them was soloing, the other was doing rhythm underneath, as well as Lemmy's rhythm bass sort of growl. It was so loud. It was so loud. And I think really that because they had sort of two younger guys came in with Phil and Wurzel, they were so excited to join. So the energy went up. And of course, Lemmy being the oldest one in the band, I think that rejuvenated him a bit because he had to keep up with these younger guys. And then, you know, Orgasmatron came and it was, we're back. You know, that's what it sort of felt like.
And you mean, I mean, let's talk about Lemmy for a minute, because I know for me, in terms of, not just musically, but I just guess in terms of like his ethos and his attitude to life and stuff, Lemmy's someone that I've looked up to for a long time. And I think even in 1986, he had that kind of aura about him. Certainly today, kind of over, you know, maybe like 7 years after his passing. Why is it that he's become such a respected and iconic part of this genre? And how important, I mean, you'd said at one point he was the only member of the band. Like, he was surely essential in keeping this ship together at quite a choppy time.
Oh, yeah. I mean, Motorhead couldn't exist without Lemmy. You know, they wouldn't have replaced it. It just wouldn't happen.
Yeah.
I mean, he was such a lovely, lovely man, as well as being the person everyone sees. That is what he was like. But he was so kind. I mean, I remember when we were recording stuff we did with him with Leader of Down, we were out in Los Angeles and we got down to the studio. It was during one of the Motorhead recording sessions. I think it was for the end of Aftershock, the Aftershock record. And I remember him saying to me, "Tim, have you had something to eat?" I said, "Yeah, thanks, Lem. I've had some food." It was about 5 o'clock. He goes, "Well, we're going to stop in a minute for some food." I said, "No, Lem, I'm fine." And he said, "Right, well, I'll order you something." And literally, I had just had something to eat. I wasn't hungry at all. And I kept saying, "No, I'm fine." And then when the food came, he goes, "I've got you some curly fries. You've got to eat." And it was just like a granddad or an uncle or whatever. Really kind. And things like, you know, he'd have all his bass guitars lined up. And he said he'd let me have a go on his sort of signature bass. So I had a go on that. And it really light and it was beautiful to play. And then he goes, "Right, I'm going to count to three. And I want you to pass it back to me." And he's going to hand me another Rickenbacker. And I've got a couple of Rickenbackers. So, you know, I've played them before. So I was now playing a normal Rickenbacker. And he goes, "Right, I'm going to count to three and we're going to swap back so you can really appreciate the difference between a normal one and his signature model." And that, so there was this, like, really sort of childish thing going on with Lemmy quickly swapping basses so I didn't forget how the previous one had felt. And it was just things like, you know, it was so nice. And he was absolutely amazing. And I think the fact that he was such an honest man and he stood by his principles, and even if people didn't agree with him, he would still say, well, that's what I think, you think what you like, you know.
Yeah.
And there's not many people who can actually do that and have the sort of strength of character to actually do that and then keep Motorhead going for all that time through thick and thin. And obviously there were periods there was a lot of thin.
And I think the mid-80s were a really good example of that, not just because of what we've been talking about, but there were difficulties with Bronze Records at the time. And obviously they kind of parted ways. Motorhead had been a huge influence on kind of this emerging thrash metal scene in America. You know, your Metallicas, your Megadeths, all of that. Struggled to get signed by a new label in spite of this, and spent much of 84 and 85 concentrating on touring. And I've got a quote from Lemmy at the time saying, Elektra passed, MCA passed, CBS passed, Epic passed, Chrysalis passed, everyone passed. Hell, I wish we sold as many albums as we do t-shirts. In England, it's pretty well over for us as far as selling a lot of albums is concerned. And I guess that's really interesting to see what his mentality was, that I guess for him at that point, he felt like the Motorhead as a studio force were maybe pretty spent at that time.
Yeah, and he said that many times, you know, throughout their career. But I do feel that sometimes things are all sort of like the right place, right time. And I think if Orgasmatron had come out when Motorhead were at their so-called peak, I think it would have still done just as well as Ace of Spades and things like that, personally.
Yeah.
It's just you can never say that because you can't change time. You know, I think it's very difficult to say. But yeah, but Lemmy still carried on. And we've still got all these wonderful memories and all the wonderful music for all of their albums. They didn't really make a bad album. There's ones people don't like as much, of course, but they didn't make a bad album. There was a very high level of consistency. But I think one of the reasons that this one, particularly Orgasmatron, means a lot to me as well, is they had to pull a good one out the bag. And they did. You know, it was vital, because I think if this had not been as good as it is or was, it could have been difficult, and like more difficult than it was over the next few years.
I mean, ultimately, in terms of kind of getting a label, Motorhead's management at the time founded GWR Records to release new material by the band, few other bands in there as well, and to secure the rights to the Bronze Record era of Motorhead. So this is a move that, you know, we could argue absolutely saved the band as kind of an ongoing entity. I mean, the only comparison I can make at that point, and that might just be ignorance on my part, I know that Queen in the early 80s, they formed Queen Productions, so their management and their studio stuff was in-house. But I think other than that, I can't really think of many other examples. Do you think this was quite a revolutionary move for Motorhead at the time, to be able to manage themselves and set up this label to ensure their survival?
Yeah, but I think so, because, you know, things like that happen a bit more now with these sort of 360 deals in music. But I can't think of anyone else at the time that it was all in-house, certainly not a band of Motorhead stature. It turned out to potentially not be the right thing for them, because then they had lots of legal things going on and all this sort of stuff. But as you've said earlier, they were having trouble getting with other labels, so it was almost like do it yourself.
So we're Motorhead back on track. The new lineup has this opportunity to gel in the studio after 2 years on the road. So in White Line Fever, and I would recommend anyone to read Lemmy's autobiography, White Line Fever, it's like essential reading. Lemmy recalls, he says, Orgasmatron was our first studio album in 3 years, and the lineup, except for me, was completely different from Another Perfect Day, but that didn't faze us any. Between the recording sessions for No Remorse and all the touring we did, the four of us were rather used to each other by then. We made the record in 11 days, which is unheard of now when you think about it. I mean, how important do you think all that time on the road was in that cohesion that we hear on Orgasmatron?
Well, it can't hurt. Yeah. And also Motorhead, for times anyway, they all lived in a house together at this point. Not all of them together, but Lemmy and Wurzel were there. Phil was there for quite a while. Pete Gill would be there and then go back up to Sheffield. You know, they and I know that Phil and Wurzel would write in one of the bedrooms and doing all sorts of things. And it was probably a very exciting time for them. So, of course, they were quite prepared in certain ways. But Lemmy, as you know, in pretty much throughout his whole career, would keep everyone guessing with how the song was actually going to go vocal, melody and lyric-wise. So they'd have all these riffs and chords and choruses, and no one would really know how the song went until Lemmy came in and put his vocals down, because he hadn't, you know, finished them, or he was waiting to get inspiration from how the sort of backing track sounded. And I know, I remember Wurzel saying to me many times that, well, we didn't have a clue how the song was going to sound. We just had this track and nobody knew, yeah. Which was lovely, really, because when we did Paradise Turned Into Dust, Leader of Down with Lemmy, it was exactly the same. I didn't know how it would sound until Lemmy sung it for the first time. Didn't have a clue.
I mean, other than those new tracks from No Remorse, Orgasmatron's actually the only studio album with Pete Gill on drums. And Metal Archives rate his performance throughout, saying the drumming strikes the balance between precision and looseness in a way that Filthy Animal never could. I mean, where would you... obviously, I know this is your favourite Motorhead album. Where does Pete stack up against kind of the likes of Filthy Animal or Mickey D or these other kind of iconic Motorhead drummers?
I think he would have stacked up right up there if he'd have managed to stay a bit longer. It's difficult to say because the others two are so iconic, but I think he did a great job. He was great live. You know, I saw them numerous times with that lineup, and yeah. He was fantastic. But he wasn't there long enough, really, because Filthy will always be the iconic Motorhead drummer, you know, from the so-called classic era. But then, of course, Mickey was with the band from 1992 onwards till the end.
Yeah.
And Pete was only there a couple of years. Mm-hmm. So it's hard to answer that, but I think he did a great job.
There's a really interesting take here from Metal Archives that I'd be really interested in hearing your opinion on. So they say, one aspect of this album that I find nobody ever really talks about is how it saw the band shift to more chorus-oriented songwriting. Past Motorhead classics certainly had their share of hooks, but they tended to just focus on the riffs, with the chorus either being a shout at the title or a quickly run-through segment, often making them feel like afterthoughts. While the choruses on Orgasmatron still aren't exactly tailored for arena rock, they certainly have a more anthemic quality than what came before. Would you agree with that? Does it feel like there's more of kind of a chorus in a lot of the songs on Orgasmatron than maybe previous albums?
Certainly on some of the tracks. So, for example, Ate My Crime, which I've already mentioned. I know that Lemmy had all sorts of harmonies he wanted on that that didn't end up in the final mix. But that is a cracking chorus. Dr. Rock... it's such a catchy song, you know, later on in the album.
Yeah.
And quite possibly there weren't as many songs. Like, for example, if you look at something like Overkill, brilliant song, but of course the chorus, it's an aggressive, hard chorus rather than a really melodic chorus. And I think on Orgasmatron, there were several tracks on there that had a very melodic chorus. So I think that's fairly... accurate in my humble opinion.
So I mean, we've said before, obviously this album, it's seen by many fans of the band as a return to form. Lemmy took issue quite a bit with the production, and you touched on that a little bit there with Ain't My Crime. I mean, Bill Laswell, who produced the album, he previously worked with acts such as Herbie Hancock and Mick Jagger, but Motorhead were unhappy with that finished product. And in White Line Fever, Lemmy says, as it turned out, Bill was good for getting sounds, but he fucked everything up in the mix. It was a much better album when he took it to New York than when he brought it back. It was dreadful. Orgasmatron was mud. So really strong words there. What are your thoughts on the production and the mix on Orgasmatron?
I think if we'd have had on that record the production that was on Ace of Spades, it would have been unbelievable. I remember listening to it, almost expecting to hear the same sounds, shall we say, as Ace of Spades, and it wasn't. But funnily enough, Cameron Webb, you know, Motorhead's producer for many, many years, who did our first two records as well, he loved the production on it. That's what got him into Motorhead. He thought it was really different sounding, and he absolutely adored the production on it. So some people loved it, some people didn't, but I don't think it was sort of thick enough overall compared to the sounds on things like Ace of Spades in particular. That obviously the band will only know what everything sounded like prior to it going off to mixing, but then I think they'd run out of time, or Bill Laswell was doing something else and they couldn't do it again, they couldn't remix it, so they were stuck with it.
So, I mean, regardless of any kind of production issues with it, Orgasmatron, it was seen as a return to form, as we've said. It reached number 21 in the UK. Death Forever made a bit of a dent in the singles chart as well. We're about to dive in track by track, but before we do, why do you think it was so well received? And where do you think it stands? I mean, obviously, I know for you, you've got that kind of personal attachment to it. Where do you think it stands amongst kind of Motorhead's greatest studio offerings?
Right. Just for a general Motorhead fans, I'd say anything between 4 and 8, as in, you know, in the top 10, between number 4 and number 8, I'd say, I guess, if I was pushed. And like I said, it's my favourite just because I love the tracks and the time of my life and then what happened afterwards, and obviously knowing quite a lot about the recording of it, because me and Wurzel talked about it intensely because he was so excited, and it was lovely to see the excitement still all those years later from Wurzel about this record.
Well, let's dive in. Let's go track by track, because you're right, there's some amazing songs on here. We'll start with Death Forever. So, of course, our opening track, something of a classic for the band, I think. What are your thoughts on Death Forever, and how does it kick off the album for you personally?
Well, as you've said, this was a single as well. When I first heard it, I was quite intrigued, because I think Death Forever in particular is very different than most of the Motorhead songs that came before it. It's a slightly different feel, and with the sort of chorus, with the chants from Wurzel and Phil, with the hoi, hoi, you know, that sort of stuff going on, it just felt slightly different, but I found it very catchy. And of course, the good thing about, shall we say, the old days is you'd listen to things numerous times. You wouldn't just listen once and dismiss it, which is what a lot of people do now. And I really got into it. And they played it live on the tour as well. And I think there is, I've sort of had memories of it, but I've got a feeling that's just my imagination. But I'm pretty certain there were times on that track when they played it live that Lemmy didn't always play the bass, because it was hard for him to sing that and play the riff at the same time. But there are lots of clips on YouTube of him playing it, so I think that might have just been very early on. But it was very catchy. It was a very catchy song, and I think it really started the album off very well. And I actually, although we've talked about the production already, I liked the production, particularly on Death Forever. I thought it had this big, very big sort of battle-type feel. You know, the clashing sword-type thing was coming into my brain when I was listening to that the first time.
It's funny how you'd said it felt like quite different from what had come before. I mean, Ultimate Classic Rock refer to the song, they say it's unusually mid-paced, I guess, in Motorhead terms. You know, does it feel like an odd choice to open the album in that sense? Or do you think it's kind of the perfect track to kick things off?
I think it possibly did before you'd listened to the rest of the songs. But then when you listen to the rest of the tracks, I think it was the perfect choice to open the album.
Yeah, I mean, Metal Reviews say Death Forever is a fine opening number. The instruments coming together perfectly with an excellent solo and killer lyrics. Lemmy's penmanship is underrated as ever. And that's something that I'll die on that hill. I'd absolutely agree. He's very underrated as a songwriter. Would you say Death Forever is a good example of what makes him such a great lyricist?
I mean, I think this whole album actually has some cracking lyrics on it. Obviously, we'll talk about Orgasmatron as we go further on. The actual song Orgasmatron, but yes, and it was the first sort of battle song that I can remember. There were other ones like Marching Off to War and things off the previous album, Another Perfect Day, but this really felt like a proper battle with swords and shields, and it really conjured up everything. So I think it was great. You know, really, really good.
I mean, as we said, it was released as a single. It reached number 67 on the UK singles chart. Become a bit of an anthem, I think, for the band as well. Just before we move on, I wanted to mention this, because I'd found, apparently, on original vinyl releases of the single for Death Forever, they came with a postcard. So this was 1986, with a competition to win a Sony Discman, which obviously at the time would have been a pretty expensive piece of kit, and Orgasmatron on the CD. And I've got the questions that were there that you could then send off to Motorhead HQ. So the questions were, which member of Motorhead wears a strapless bra underneath the stage clothes? Which member of Motorhead has two adorable little bunnies called Mopsy and Garfunkel? Do you think there is a valid place for Motorhead to occupy in today's urban military industrial wasteland? True or false? And finally, do you feel that Motorhead say one thing 1 minute and out the other? Specify inside leg measurement. So, I think it's just a really good indicator. Like, I always think kind of the humour of Lemmy and the band was always a huge part of their appeal.
Oh, most definitely. And they were like that all the time. You know, I mean, it really was. Like, for example, I'd be talking to Wurzel, and if someone came up that we didn't know, he'd suddenly say to me really loudly, "You bitter, bitter man." And I go, well, just so the people who were standing closer thought we were having a big argument. You know, it was all always like that. You know, it was so much fun. And the good thing with Motorhead, they allowed the fans, shall we say, to see their personal humour, and Lemmy in particular. But they were all like it. You know, it was brilliant.
So let's move on with to Nothing Up My Sleeve. A blabbermouth say, Nothing Up My Sleeve is a straight-ahead slammer with a vintage Lemmy bass intro and some wild and woolly guitar soloing. I mean, obviously, that sounds, you know, that sounds like how every great Motorhead song should sound. What would you say the ingredients are, as a Motorhead fan yourself? What are the ingredients for a great Motorhead song that are on display here?
I think most Motorhead fans do like the tracks where Lemmy starts it and there's a bass intro. They're normally a decent sort of up-tempo track, the ones that Lemmy starts. And this was a great song, Nothing Up My Sleeve. And of course, with all the Tommy Cooper type humour in the lyrics. And it was just brilliant. And Lemmy quite often would introduce it on the tour and around that time as, you know, Nothing Up My Sleeve, although I'm actually lying, you know, and things like that. And it was great. And it just seemed, I don't know, like the fun was back. Whereas, although I do love Another Perfect Day, the previous record, it really did seem like the fun was back.
And I mean, to be fair, we could probably talk for an entire podcast about Lemmy and just his presence as a front man and all of this kind of stuff. But for those who might not be aware, perhaps people who, because again, obviously, I'm sure we'll have Motorhead fanatics listening, but maybe people who are more casual. What is it about him that made him such a unique bass player? Because again, he was a very different animal in terms of how he
approached bass. Yeah, because Lemmy was a guitarist originally, and when he joined Hawkwind, he didn't play the bass. He just got the job because the bass player hadn't turned up, and Dick Mick, I think, from Hawkwind said, "Oh, Lemmy plays the bass," and up he went. So he plays it in a way a little bit more like a guitarist would, and it's sort of become like a bass rhythm guitar. And the people that, for example, sometimes knock Motor and say, "Oh, it's just heavy noise and stuff," they're missing the point, because if you actually try to play like Lemmy, it's very difficult. It doesn't play like a normal bass player plays. There's a lot of drone strings where he just lets one ring while he's playing other things. And he is one of the few bass players that have really, if you hear it, you know it's Lemmy. And you know, you really can't give a higher compliment than that. You know it's Lemmy. And he had a very unusual sound with it all, how he had his amp set up. There's no bass, you know, it's all top end, and it just sounded brilliant. Tim Butcher, who's Lemmy's bass tech for years and years and years, said it many times that Lemmy wanted almost the sound of like a Stuka dive bomber. That was how he wanted it to sound. And well, he got a unique sound that filled up a three-piece band, in theory, you know, earlier on in their career, so it didn't all drop out when the guitar solo was going on. And of course, then when it was a four-piece, it was even thicker and louder than ever before.
I mean, hidden amongst an otherwise positive review from Metal Storm, there's a bit of mild criticism for Nothing Up My Sleeve. So they say, "As I play the album through again and again, I only find one track that doesn't impress me, Nothing Up My Sleeve, which in fact is not all that bad for a filler track." And it's a word, I hate the word filler, but it's one that comes up when we're doing these kinds of things. Would you say, like, does it feel like a filler track to you? Is there any filler on this album?
Well, I don't think the band thought it was a filler track, because they played it live a lot of times, and even in later years, they played it. It might be, you know, sometimes when people are reviewing things, they can't like every song, and it's obviously your personal taste. It may be that it's a bass intro start, and it's not as good, say, as Ace of Spades, which has, a bass intro start. I don't know. But I actually don't think there are any, so we say, filler tracks. I've got least favourite tracks, which we'll come on to as we go along. But again, that's just personal taste. Some people that might be their favourite, you know.
I think some of our best episodes are when there's like a personal link there. So, you know, certainly for Tim, he was a Motorhead fan, is a Motorhead fan, who then became friends with the band. You know, he formed a band with Wurzel, who plays on the album that we're talking about today. Lemmy appeared as a guest vocalist on their first album. You know, he knows Phil Campbell really well, you know. So crazy to think, you know, they say don't meet your heroes, but I guess that Tim would absolutely go against that, and he's got some amazing stories, as you've heard. We'll continue going track by track with Orgasmatron in just a little bit. But first, you know, Leader of Down, not only kind of a side project, for lack of a better word, for Wurzel back in the day, but, you know, they're kind of carrying on the spirit of Motorhead, which is really exciting, you know. And, you know, for Motorhead fans like me, it's just great to hear that there's bands still out there really going for it. And, you know, Leader of Down are a great example of it. So here is a track from their latest album, The Screwtape Letters. This is Leader of Down with Hitman. We've talked about Ain't My Crime a couple of times, and that's where we're at now. So again, some more praise from Blabbermouth, who say Ain't My Crime boasts one of the band's most catchy and shamefully underrated choruses, as well as this defining Lemmy line, "I'm low life, born and bred, and I don't give a damn." So we talked about this movement towards the band embracing a chorus beyond kind of Ace of Spades, for example. Is Ain't My Crime a good example of this kind of more elaborate chorus, for lack of a better way of putting it?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I'll give you an example. When me and Wurzel started Leader of Down, the idea was that we were going to try to sound, in our own way, obviously, a bit more like the more obviously catchy Motorhead songs, but without a Lemmy sound-alike vocalist. Mm-hmm. And some of the songs we talked about were things like Too Good to Be True, Off March or Die, All For You, which is off the Rock and Roll album, and Ain't My Crime off Orgasmatron. So Wurzel thought Ain't My Crime was one of the more obviously catchy tracks. I did as well. And I think this was a period where Motorhead had these very catchy songs, but they retained the real rawness and heaviness, particularly because of Lemmy's vocal style. So even if Lemmy was singing, you know, an ABBA song, it would still sound aggressive because of his voice. And yeah, I think they were potentially getting into this place where they realised they could do some pretty catchy stuff here that would still sound really heavy. And that's the thing, I think, with most of the Motorhead back catalogue, people who actually get into it are pleasantly surprised how catchy and how much swing there is in the music.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, I managed to pick out some criticism of this one from both the band and some other sources. So I'll start with Sputnik Music, who they talk about like a lack of a solo that they think is greatly frustrating. You know, bearing in mind there's kind of two guitarists in this lineup, you know, do you think it would have benefited from a solo or perhaps kind of something a bit more to it?
I've never really thought about that. I think it's great as it is, personally.
Yeah, fair. I mean, when I was talking about that kind of criticism from the band, obviously, and I think you'd said this yourself earlier, so Lemmy singled this out as an example of why he didn't like the production on the album, and he'd said there was supposed to be a four-part harmony on this on this track, but the producer wiped three of them out, and that's where that Orgasmatron was mud quote comes from. You know, four-part harmonies aren't exactly the kind of thing that I'd expect, but I think I would absolutely have loved to have heard. Do you think that would have worked on here? Like, what do you think that would have been like?
I think it'd have been great. I mean, I think the thing is, obviously, it would have all been mixed in accordingly, so it would have still sounded very, very aggressive. But Lemmy, and I've seen this firsthand, not just on the song that we did with him, but when I've seen him recording Motorhead vocals, he was great at doing harmonies. Mm-hmm. I mean, really good. And of course, they'd be mixed in a way, it just thickened the track. And I think that it would have been brilliant. I think it would have been absolutely brilliant. And I think, obviously, that's what Lemmy was planning. And maybe that's why the chorus was so catchy, because he was thinking of all these harmonies.
Yeah. So let's move on to Claw, with the album kind of powering on. Yet more praise from Blabbermouth. It's a great review to read, actually. They single out the song saying, "The stop-start boogie crush and thunderous drumming of Claw make it particularly memorable." And obviously, we've talked about quite a few of these tracks that are really strong ones for you. What are your thoughts on this one?
Well, this is my least favourite one on the album.
Okay.
And I'll tell you why. It's basically a continuation of what we've been talking about. The chorus isn't as catchy for me on this track. And as it's come straight after Ain't My Crime, which is very, very catchy, it didn't do it for me as much as the other tracks. I like the song, mm-hmm, but it's just one that didn't quite get me in the same way that the majority of the rest of the album did.
I mean, Metal Archives say of the song, they say, "Even a song where the chorus is just the title, like The Claw, has a sense of urgency, with Lemmy almost going full Halford with his screams at the climax." I mean, obviously, they're very different vocalists, but obviously it sounds like you'd agree there's maybe a comparison to be made there.
Lemmy's vocal performance on it is amazing, especially as it gets towards the end and he's really screaming. And he did a superb performance on it. I just felt that the chorus wasn't really catchy, but I think some of that could also be where it was situated in the running order, because it had come straight after probably one of the most catchiest songs on the record.
Yeah, and it is so interesting. It's something I think it's a bit of a lost art now. I mean, I know vinyl's made a bit of a comeback and stuff, but when, you know, so many people stream, I think that sequence of an album has become a bit of a lost art, hasn't it?
Oh, definitely. It was really important. And on our new record that we brought out, you know, a few weeks ago, we worked really hard to try and get the running order correct. Because if you do, shall we say, a weaker track, then sets up one of the stronger tracks even more, rather than you having all the single type songs all in a line, you know, all in a row.
Yeah. So the 2004 Sanctuary reissue of Orgasmatron has an alternate version of Claw on it. Have you heard that version? And if so, what did you make of it compared to the album version?
Yeah, no, I've got it. I've heard it. It's funny. It's hard, really, to say, because you get so used to the original version. So I just, sometimes when I see the alternate versions and things, they're just nice to listen to. But yeah, I think they picked the right version, personally, for the album.
So let's move on to Mean Machine as we come to the end of side one. Again, if we're talking vinyl. Sputnik Music, note a thrash metal vibe, saying Mean Machine greatly reminds of something that could be found off Kill 'Em All by Metallica, with its raw thrash metal-esque riff that dominates the song. So of course Motorhead were, Metallica are not ashamed at all to say that Motorhead were a huge influence on them. You know, for those less familiar with Motorhead, obviously Metallica, one of the biggest bands in the world. When you're listening to Metallica, where do you hear that influence in Metallica's music?
Personally, I don't think Metallica swing anywhere near as much as Motorhead did. So that the heaviness is there and certain progressions and things they have in their music. But I think the real difference is Motorhead really swung and it really was rock and roll, but just heavy rock and roll. You know, Motorhead had more of a Eddie Cochran type feel with everything as well. Whereas Metallica were a bit straighter, maybe is the phrase I'm looking for. But you could definitely hear it, you know.
Obviously, again, we're talking 1986 by this point, so Orgasmatron's coming out the same year as like Master of Puppets, and obviously Metallica. And that, I think that's probably the moment that Metallica, you know, it's certainly in the metal scene kind of explode. You know, obviously I know the Black Album would make them an international success, really, but do you think that Mean Machine feels like a case of just Motorhead being Motorhead, or do you think there is kind of an acknowledgement of what was going on in the thrash scene and maybe like a nod to that on Mean Machine?
I think, you know, if you asked anyone from Motorhead at the time, they'd obviously been aware of what was going on, but I don't think they were ever going to change to just be the latest fad. But I would imagine I think sometimes if you're aware of something, sometimes subconsciously you could be doing things accordingly without even really knowing you're doing it to move forward. But I prefer Mean Machine to Claw, and I think there's a lot of typical, shall we say, Motorhead type parts to Mean Machine. And it was also great live. They played it live a few times as well, and it was great.
I mean, in terms of, again, if we're thinking about it as kind of two sides to the album, how does this end side one? Does it feel like a strong end to the first half of the album?
It does. It does. I mean, one of the things sometimes I always used to think was that maybe Claw should have ended it just because of the Overkill style drums. Mm. But, you know, there's not a lot in it. But yeah, I think it's a good end to the album. Yeah. You know, it works. Works for me.
So we'll flip it over. So side two starts with Built for Speed. So Blabbermouth say side two begins with Lemmy's ode to the rock and roll lifestyle, Built for Speed, a mid-paced iron and steel chugger with lyrics that will have you singing right along with Kilmister. I mean, what are your thoughts on Built for Speed? You know, obviously we only had one single from this album in Death Forever. Do you think Built for Speed would have been a good follow-up?
I loved Built for Speed because it used to be called On the Road. Mm. And they played it live. And as On the Road before Orgasmatron came out, and then Lemmy changed the lyrics so that it was a bit of a surprise when it was then called Built for Speed when it came out, because I'd heard it as On the Road prior. But I love the lyrics to this song, particularly slightly different pace than the tracks we've just had with two sort of ferocious rockers with Claw and Mean Machine. And I think, yeah, this is catchy. Very catchy. And yeah, it probably could have been a single, but I think there's other tracks on the album which we'll come to, maybe like Dr. Rock and Orgasmatron, that probably would have been better singles if they were choosing another one.
Yeah, I mean, obviously if we're talking about catchy songs, I mean, Metal Archives totally agree, they call it one of the catchiest songs on the album. Is it about the lyrics? Is it the lyrics that make it catchy? Is there something in terms of the music? What is it that works for you?
I think the tempo and the pace of the song, how it all fits together, is perfect. You know, and then you add the lyrics, and of course, because the lyrics are slower, because it's a slower song, Lemmy can really accentuate certain words and really make it sound aggressive. I remember when one of the lines is like the new religion, the electric church, the only way to go, you know, that sort of thing. You know, I don't give a damn. Yeah, my life's been all right, you know, all that sort of stuff. And I seem to remember them singing, you know, I was born with my trousers down and things like that. I seem they were just joking around with some of those things as well, live. But it was great. It was great. And I think Lemmy did a really good vocal on this track.
I mean, we've talked a little bit about some criticism from Sputnik Music. They've got some for Built for Speed. They say Built for Speed tricks you a little bit with its song title, as in reality it's the slowest song of this album. The riffs seem to chug more in this one, and after a while it becomes a tad bit more repetitive and bland than the previous songs. I know you'd said, obviously, that you're a big fan of this song, as am I. Is that harsh criticism, or do you feel that there is an element of kind of repetition to it?
Was this a review from the time?
No,
it's a more recent one. I don't know. No, I think that's a bit harsh. I think it's a bit harsh. But I think as the years have gone on, this really stands up as a really good Lemmy lyric. It's a tongue twister there. Really good Lemmy lyric. And it's him. You know, you can see I'm Built for Speed. You know, it was perfect.
So I feel like with that Sputnik Music, I'm picking out only the bad stuff. So I've got some positive stuff from that review for Riding with the Driver, which is next. So they say Riding with the Driver picks up the tempo once again with the classic Motorhead straightforward type riffing. And this time, the guitar plays exactly the same as the bass, no quick fills at the end or whatnot. I mean, what are your thoughts on Riding with the Driver? I know you'd said, obviously, which we'll get to, this was the working title for the album. I've read some sources that call it a bit of a fan favourite.
I don't think they ever played it live. Mm-hmm. I'm pretty certain they didn't. I always liked the lyrics, but, you know, talking to Wurzel and Lemmy about it, neither of them were... I haven't actually spoken to Phil Campbell about it. I should ask him. It didn't become the song they thought it was going to. It certainly doesn't stand up as much as Dr. Rock does, mm-hmm. for example. But I think it could have been a better song, but I'm just struggling to think how. But they might have had to gone back to basics and just change some of it, because some of it comes from also from the melodies you pick for the vocals as well. But the lyrics are great. You know, there's some real good lyrics on here.
Do you think maybe that little bit of kind of dissatisfaction with it, do you think that played a factor in Lemmy changing the name of the album?
I think definitely. But you'll notice again with Riding with the Driver, it's one that the chorus isn't a particularly overly catchy chorus. It's a good chorus, but it's not like Ain't My Crime or Dr. Rock. You know, hey, Riding with the Driver. It's a bit more of a standard type chorus. I don't know, but it's a great track. I don't think there's a poor one on the record. It's fantastic, but there's obviously going to be ones I prefer than to others.
And I mean, as we've said a few times throughout our chat, you know, Riding with the Driver was the working title for this album before, and I've read maybe even days before Lemmy had decided, actually, you know what, I want to change it to Orgasmatron. Joe Patango, who's done loads of the artwork for Motorhead albums over the years, he clearly didn't get the memo in time, because that amazing artwork for this album is based on Riding with the Driver.
Yes, exactly.
I mean, one of my favourite Motorhead covers, full stop. What do you make of kind of the cover of this album with the Snaggletooth train? And how important do you think Joe's contributions have been to that kind of the image of Motorhead over the years?
I mean, massive contribution. You know, I think along with Eddie from Iron Maiden, the Motorhead logo is the most famous logo there is, certainly in heavy rock. And I don't know what the title would have looked like if it was Orgasmatron,
yeah,
as in the cover, because mm-hmm. I don't know what it'd come out. But Wurzel loved trains, Lemmy loved trains, and they'd often be in the rehearsal studio if they were near a train track. They'd all be looking out the windows because Wurzel massively into trains, so it would have been a big thing for them to have a big train on the cover.
Yeah,
and I think it's a great cover. It's one of their, you know, most iconic covers, certainly of out of the big sort of three or four records. It's right up there.
I think the album ends particularly strong with our last two songs. So Dr. Rock is one of my all-time favourite Motorhead songs. I think it's absolutely phenomenal. Blabbermouth praise it's calling it an underrated monster that boasts more of Lemmy's tongue-in-cheek lyrical lunacy and a locomotive propulsion complete with billowing smoke. Obviously, we've talked so much about the strength of the lyrics and the songwriting on this album. Is Dr. Rock a highlight of that?
Dr. Rock is one of my favourite Motorhead tracks. I think it's so catchy. And Motorhead did things like, you know, opened with it, had it somewhere else in the first three tracks, later in the set. But it was one of the ones that stayed in the set for many years, and then always made a return a few years later if they dropped it.
Yeah.
And it's such a good song.
I mean, that's a really good question, because I know when, like I say, I saw them 3 or 4 times over the years, and I can tell you now, they played Dr. Rock every time. Like, I remember that for a fact. Why do you think, obviously, because again, it wasn't released as a single. Obviously, Death Forever was the single, but it became such this integral part of their live set. Why do you think that is?
I think it's just a good song. And the lyrics, again, things like, you know, you've got a body like a Marshall stack. You know, I've got the medicine you need. All that sort of thing worked great. And they came across really well live. And it's a real sort of, I don't want to say the word dancey song, but you get what I mean. You know, mm-hmm. you can move about to it, and it's just amazing. It's just a brilliant song, and everyone loved that song.
Yeah.
And you know, obviously Lemmy liked it, or they wouldn't have kept doing it.
Definitely. I mean, Ultimate Classic Rock believed that Dr. Rock, like some of the songs on the album, clearly benefited from marinating a little while longer during the band's extended layoff. So we talked about, obviously, that touring that was happening around the album, giving that opportunity for the band to kind of get to know each other musically and gel. Do you think that Dr. Rock has that feel of, like, bearing in mind this is the first album by this lineup, does it feel like that it was kind of perfected throughout that constant touring, and that the band are really firing on all cylinders with this one?
Most definitely. I think that's a really good description. It's got the Motorhead groove. It's got great lyrics that all the Motorhead fans would have sort of associated with.
Mm-hmm.
And I think everything just fell into place. And I think that shows you that they were playing it at the end, and it came out in the mid-80s, and they were still doing it. And it wasn't, as you say, a single. It wasn't Ace of Spades, Bomber, Overkill, or anything like that. It was a song from Orgasmatron. And they were still playing. And like I said, sometimes opening with it. And you've got to have a strong song to open a set with. Certainly, yeah, with Motorhead's back catalogue.
So we'll move on to our final track, the title track. Obviously, we've alluded to it a few times so far, and that is Orgasmatron. Similar to Dr. Rock, it's become a firm favourite with Motorhead fans. Obviously, there's a lot to unpick with this one, but what are your thoughts on it before we dive in too much?
I remember in all the fan club magazines that they were talking about that the lyrics were amazing to this, because the guy who ran the fan club, Alan Burridge, had been to sort of rehearsals and bits and pieces, and he was giving sort of his feedback on everything. And it was built up quite a lot with the sort of Motorhead fans in the fan club that this was going to be something special.
Mm.
And wow, we weren't disappointed. I really wasn't expecting it to sound how it did, because you had no idea what it was going to sound like until you heard it. But I seem to remember Wurzel saying to me that when they were doing it, when they were coming up with it, Lemmy or one of the guys said, well, let's just have one chord over it. You know, there's bits around it, but let's do that. And then the lyric is what really makes it.
Mm-hmm.
And it just plods and drives and plods and drives. And it's amazing. And of course, live, Lemmy used to be lit up with sort of green lights on him. And it was just amazing. And I think with the set, it gave them a completely different feel of a track that they'd never had that before. And it was perfect in the set, because it was just great. I mean, amazing. And I think it's hard to say what Lemmy's best ever lyrics were, but these have got to be right up there.
Mm-hmm.
Really good rhymes with really good words, you know, not just rhyming play with way or something like, you know, there's some cracking rhymes in it.
So in the Motorhead memoir Overkill, The Untold Story of Motorhead, Lemmy discusses his inspiration for the song. So he said, it refers to the three things I hate most in life: organized religion, politics, and war. Things like people that go to church and come in their pants while communicating with Jesus Christ. It's all a bunch of bullshit. If you're really into that, you don't need to go to church or talk to God. You can talk to him everywhere. Or if you join a political party and get your jollies off that, when your party wins and all that, it's the herd instinct. The same thing with war. They give you a nice new uniform and march you off to die. So I think these are things that throughout career, these are things that he wrote about quite a lot. In terms of Lemmy's songwriting, and we've talked about the evolution of that a little bit, does this feel like the start of that? Was he writing about these kinds of things before Orgasmatron? Or do you think that this is kind of where that creeps into his songwriting a bit more.
I think it certainly crept in more after this. Mm-hmm. I think with some of the earlier tracks, you don't hear as much about the war or battles and things like that. So I think this is more, you know, more like the start or where it became a little bit more regular.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I don't think he's better a sort of lyric that's sort of complaining about politicians, religion, war in any track he ever did lyrically.
So no, Metal Archives have huge praise for the song, as most of the reviews I've read did, saying Orgasmatron is unlike any other Motorhead song that came before it, consisting of a simple but ungodly dark trudging drone interspersed with swirling distortion and the vocals delivered in an effect-laden growl. All the past themes of politics and warfare and past songs are given full attention, resulting in what may be the most cynically brilliant set of lyrics Lemmy ever composed, and giving life to what could have been an otherwise dragging experimental rocker. Future efforts would see the occasional attempt to repeat this formula, but nothing could ever be this striking, which I think sums up a lot of what we've just said, to be fair. I mean, I've read as well, like, I mean, I know Sepultura covered it, for example. A lot of people talk about this song potentially having an influence on kind of black and death metal. You know, is that something that you could see?
Oh, I think most definitely. I mean, I think Motorhead, really, when they were doing this, were very brave, because this was a... There's no other Motorhead songs prior to this track that sound anywhere like this. Mm-hmm. And because this album had to be such a good one, you know, this was a brave thing to do. But they pulled it off amazingly. And I can see, you know, with the sort of doomy type sound, this would have been a big influence for a lot of the sort of death type bands. But it's still, again, got a groove that only Motorhead, in my opinion, have ever had, really, with how the song goes. Because it's still catchy, even though it doesn't go a lot of places melodically. It's still catchy, and I am the one, Orgasmatron, you know. You've still got it. And when it changes, you know, halfway through the change, it's great. It was such a good song live as well. Again, even though it's not catchy like Dr. Rock, it was just a different feel. And I think they placed this perfectly as the last track, also just after Dr. Rock, which is probably one of the catchiest songs on the record. It set Orgasmatron up for almost like for the big finish.
Yeah. It's like that home run, if you like.
Yeah, definitely. And something completely different that you just suddenly go, whoa. Wow, I just heard that. Crumbs. I knew it was good lyrics. I'd heard about this. And here we go. Here we go.
I mean, with that mind, within the context of the album, you know, you've said it's the perfect ending. How does Orgasmatron end the album for you? Where are you kind of when you get to the end of this album?
Well, in all honesty, I want to then put it back on again.
Yeah.
That's how I feel, because I think you're almost ready then for something a bit faster and go back to the beginning. And because then Death Forever is not the blistering, full-paced opener that some of the other tracks could have been if they were first, it works really nicely when you play it to the end, to Orgasmatron, then go back to Death Forever. It works really nicely as a loop of songs. So obviously when, you know, in days gone by when you'd buy the vinyl, that's what you do. You wouldn't just listen to the record once. You'd finish it, flip it over and start again. And I remember it just working amazingly. You know, and then like I was saying to you as well, in latter years, talking to Wurzel and all these other things, Bill Laswell, the producer, introduced Wurzel to the rat pedal, mm-hmm. you know, the effects pedal, the rat distortion pedal, and he'd not used it before. So this was the first record Wurzel used his rat distortion pedal, and he absolutely loved it, because Wurzel wasn't really into like sort of hundreds and hundreds of different effects. He'd have the things he liked, just a few, and he used that, and I think he got a really, really good guitar sound. I know Wurzel was really pleased with the sound and his performance on the album, and he played brilliantly. So did Phil. They all did.
Yeah.
You know, they all did. And I think it was, I was just sort of thinking whilst we were talking earlier, I think it was Riding With The Driver, that the solo on there, Wurzel's solo, he'd gone like really high and it had gone a bit strange. And the Bill Laswell said to Wurzel, you've gone into the mosquito frequency. and they kept it, and it sounds great because Wurzel used to pull out some very different, very interesting solos, and they kept that one. Yeah. And well, I think Wurzel was ready to do it again, but they all loved it, which again is typical Motorhead.
Yeah,
typical Motorhead.
I mean, obviously, while these early Motorhead albums are rightly celebrated, you know, your Ace of Spades, your Overkill, Bomber, Orgasmatron is an important album in their storied career. And as we've said, a really well-timed return to form. And I've got a quote from Metal Archives who kind of just talk about the significance of the album. So
yeah.
They say, Orgasmatron may not have the brand recognition of Overkill or Ace of Spades, but it's secretly one of the most important albums in Motorhead's history. It effectively bridges the gap between the looseness of their classic era with the more consciously metallic tightness of their later years. The admittedly odd production job can make it easy to pass up, and the phallic snaggletooth train on the album cover might be a bit too gaudy for some, but it's ultimately just as worthy of your attention as their best-known staples. Future installments like Bastards and Inferno would arguably take this approach with even more powerful returns, but this was the start of a very solid second wind. So, I mean, with all that in mind and everything we've talked about, why do you think, or how do you think Orgasmatron has stood the test of time?
It's an interesting question, Mike. I pretty much agree with everything that reviewer had just read out. I don't think Motorhead would have gone on to have the career they did if this wasn't such a strong album. Because they'd had all these legal wranglings and everything and hadn't been able to record, and Bronze, you know, all the problems there and bits and pieces. They really needed to pull out a cracker, and they did. The cover, I think, is great, and I think it's so important. It was such an important record for them. If the production, as we said earlier, had been slightly thicker and slightly different and a bit more to the band's liking, I think you could have been looking at a return to sort of Ace of Spades territory, personally. But, you know, it wasn't to be. But it, as you said, it did pretty well, and I think it really was the bridge between, like, the Eddie Clarke era and the so-called, you know, the classic lineup, as they call it sometimes, into the new era of Motorhead. And I remember always saying to Wurzel, you know, when we was talking about him being in the band, he was in it 11 years. Now, most people, that's the length of three bands, let alone one. And, of course, he was only in it for 11 years because Motorhead went 40 years. But 11 years on its own is a hell of a stint. And this was one that I know they were all excited about, first one. And I think it really shows. And I think they did a fantastic job. And I can remember being absolutely thrilled as a kid when I heard it. And I still am now.
And finally, why is Orgasmatron your classic album? And why should people check it out if they haven't already?
Well, I'll start with the first bit. Why they should check it out is possibly because if you're not a big Motorhead fan, you will only know the Ace of Spades, Bomber type tracks. Killed by Death and things like that. This one has some very underrated gems on there, and it possibly will give you another change of view maybe on what you think of Motorhead if you're not a fan. As a fan, sometimes, this is just me speaking personally, everyone of course loves the big tracks, you know, Overkill, Kill by Death, all that sort of stuff, Ace of Spades, but sometimes it's nice to have some other ones because you've heard those so many times that maybe aren't as well known but you know secretly are just as good. And Orgasmatron does that to me. I want to listen to it again. I love the whole era with it. The early four-piece stuff was the time that I really started getting into actually being able to go to see shows. And, of course, that always will have a big affection for you as a person when these were around the time that you were seeing your favourite band for the first time.
Well, Tim, thank you so much for joining me. It's been great to hear not only your thoughts on the album, but kind of, you know, those experiences with Wurzel and Lemmy and the rest of the guys. So thank you so much for joining me.
Pleasure, Mike. I've had a great time.
Lovely. I mean, obviously, you've been saying there, I know that the second album from Leader of Down is out now. What are the plans kind of for the rest of the year? You know, is there some kind of touring going on, or what are the plans?
Yeah, well, we've just done two shows in the last 10 days with Phil Campbell. Which was great. We've got another show about to be announced in June, and then we're doing a short UK tour in July, and then we'll be going off to Europe in the autumn and winter this year, and we've got loads of shows being booked for next year already. It's been a bit difficult this year, certainly with some of the festivals, because some of the festivals haven't happened since 2019.
Yeah.
So they've still got the lineup they were going to have in 2020 going to be playing this summer. So once the backlog is cleared, it'll be a bit easier. But we're booked on for quite a lot of festivals for next year. So it's looking good, and people clapped and said hip hip hooray when we played some of the new songs the other day, which always helps. So yeah, everything's going pretty well at the moment.
Massive thanks to Tim Atkinson for taking time out and indulging the Motorhead fanboy in me as well, and telling me some cool Lemmy and Wurzel stories. And yeah, I mean, great to have him on the show. Great to kind of open Motorhead's account on My Classic Album, as it were. And Orgasmatron is a great album. You know, if you're listening to this and you've maybe only heard kind of the singles or kind of those classic, you know, Bomber, Ace of Spades, Orgasmatron is definitely worth your time and want to go and check out. So thank you to Tim for joining me. And as I said, kind of halfway through the show there, their album, The Screwtape Letters, is out now, and it's totally worth a listen. But that'll do it for another episode of My Classic Album. Thank you very much for joining me. But in the meantime, I'll kind of leave you for another couple of weeks. And my next episode, I'll be joined by Tim DeWitt from Deep Fall to chat all about Alice in Chains' second studio album, Dirt. So until then, I've been Mike Norris, and I'll see you in a couple of weeks. Cheers.